It was the garnet wool jersey with the peplum waist they'd picked out together at Godshalk's on a trip to New Orleans with Genevieve. Reaching down, Vivi rubbed her fingers across the fabric. The material seemed to come up and meet the flesh of her fingertips. Teensy placed her hand over Vivi's.
Baby, that outfit you're wearing has got to go.
Got to go, Vivi repeated after her, trying for the old ya-ya tone.
Got to,
Genevieve said, and lit a cigarette, tears in the corners of her eyes. They rode along in silence for a mile or so before Genevieve spoke again.
Écoutez, femme,
she said, her voice like the slow-moving, rich bayou itself, her tone wavering somewhere between tears and ferocity.
God don't like ugly, mes petits choux, ça va? No matter what they try to tell you, baby, God don't make ugly, and God don't like ugly. Le bon Dieu is a God of loveliness, and don't y'all forget it.
Yes, maman, Teensy said.
Yes, maman, Vivi said. And Vivi, ma petite chou, écoutez voir ici. Life is short, but it is wide. This too shall pass.
With those catechism lessons, Genevieve drove Vivi, mile by mile, all the way back home. Chapter 22. The girl in the photo on the front page of the Thornton High Tatler from May 21, 1943, was so thin and drawn-looking that at first Sitta did not recognize her mother. My God, Sitta thought. She looks like a war orphan. Accompanying the photo was the following item. Thornton favorite returns home. Vivi Abbott, sophomore cheerleader, beauty, and varsity tennis player, has returned from St. Augustine's Academy in Spring Hill, Alabama, where she spent almost all of the past semester. Sorely missed by the entire student body, Vivi is welcomed back by everyone, from the football team to the Red Cross canteen. Have a great summer, Vivi. Even with Jack gone, we know you and the Yayas will be in high form. Sitta ached for more information. Searching the scrapbook, she examined each pressed corsage, each ticket stub, willing there to be more information about her mother's departure and return from St. Augustine's. She tried to imagine what her mother's life had been like during the summer of 1943. Shoes were rationed, along with meat and cheese. But what else was rationed? Was her return difficult, or did Vivi rise above it, as she'd always told her children to do? When she could find no other information, Sitta began to make it up. Say Mama flourished that summer. Say she was safe and loved. Say the newspaper clipping tells the whole story. Golden girl, universally welcomed home. Say Mama watched Casablanca when it first came out and necked with whatever boy she was with. Say she was beautiful and blonde and more popular than I ever was. Say Mama did not know what lay in store for her and woke every morning grinning. Say there is no truth. Say there are only scraps that we feebly try to sew together. Vivi Abbott Walker lay on the table in the small rose-colored room with the piped-in music at Shea Health, ready to let Tori, the massage therapist, touch her body. Nisi had been the first to discover Tori, and now all the Yayas made appointments to lay their aging bodies on her table and indulge in a sensual pampering that the church they grew up in would have labeled a sin of indulgence, if not a near occasion of sin. Once a week, Vivi took off her clothes, lay down, and babbled nervously for 10 minutes. Then, as her breathing grew deeper, she gave over to the stroking she craved. Never in her life had Vivi been showered with such physical attention, no strings attached.
"A bargain at any price, Tori darling," she said at the end of each session as she handed a check, complete with generous tip, to the massage therapist.
Now, as Tori massaged her feet and toes, Vivi felt herself sink down into the table. She found herself, as she had many times in the past week or so, thinking about Jack. Vivi had done her best to reclaim her old life when she returned from St. Augustine's. She had tiptoed back onto the tennis court, where her weight loss and exhaustion embarrassed her no end. She had hung out at Bordelon's Drugs and drunk Coca-Colas with peanuts plunked into the bottles. She wrote Jack cheery letters at least every other day, and she tried to stay out of her mother's way. Buggy had refused even to speak to her for the first month Vivi was back home. But as the summer passed, things began to return to what passed for normal life in the Abbott house. Vivi said regular novenas for Jack and tried to get excited about the other boys she still dated. But even after she began to eat again, to rediscover some of the energy she'd lost, there was something about her that hesitated, that held back, that hedged her bets. Now she did not know who she was or what she was supposed to do, and she did not know exactly when she had stepped away from herself. She did not know if she would ever stop feeling tired. She learned to camouflage her exhaustion with a slightly forced vitality. She became a high priestess of self-presentation and was rewarded for it at every turn. The town of Thornton, Louisiana, extolled self-presentation. It was a sort of religion. It had been a Sunday afternoon, the third week of June, 1943, not long after she'd returned from St. Augustine's. Jack was home for a visit before departing for a bomber base somewhere in Europe. Buggy had suggested that the gang come back to the Abbott home that afternoon for some homemade ice cream. All week long, there had been swimming parties, barbecues, and get-togethers to celebrate Jack's visit. Vivi, Jack, Caro, Niecy, and Teensy had just walked over from the Whitman house, where Genevieve had prepared a meal that included every one of her son's favorite foods, from St. Landry crayfish bisque to Mayhaw jelly rolls. It was early summer, not yet unbearably hot. The clematis vine was in full bloom, and blackberries trailed along the fence in wild profusion. Some of the berries, picked and washed by Buggy, were already gathered in a big yellow bowl that sat on the steps. Vivi's baby sister, Jessie, quiet for once, leaned against her mother's leg as Buggy stood cranking the ice cream freezer. Buggy wore the lilac and gray house dress she changed into every Sunday after Mass. Her hair was caught up in two combs at the side of her face, and her cheeks were slightly flushed from the exertion of the cranking. Pete was draped over the porch railing with a couple of his buddies. Vivi sat on the swing between Teensy and Niecy. Caro leaned against a column, her feet kicked out in front of her, crossed at the ankles. Jack sat in a straight-back chair in the middle of all of them, his fiddle in his lap. Not just any fiddle, but the handmade Cajun fiddle his Uncle LeBlanc had made for him when he was 9 years old. The fiddle his father forbade him to play inside the house because it smacked of the bayou, of a world unacceptable to the prosperous banker. But, oh, Jack played on every single visit to Genevieve's people in Marksville, on the bayou. And he played it at all his friends' houses, and he played in the middle of fields when Genevieve loaned them the Packard, and they'd head out to Spring Creek with picnic blankets and a couple of six-packs. Jack's French fiddle joined with the music of Harry James to break Vivi's heart in those days. Once, after she'd sprained her ankle on the tennis court and was laid up in bed in the foulest mood, Jack had played under her bedroom window, making her feel like Juliet. Another time, she put him up to playing during a basketball game halftime in the Thornton High Gymnasium. There, Jack Whitman stood, waving that bow across the strings, his long legs flowing out of his gold and blue satin basketball uniform, his head tossed back with the music, a wide grin sweeping across his face. And now he was home again, his father's pride. Never had Vivi seen Jack so contented. His father had bragged about him all week long. Mr. Whitman, in fact, had been the one to arrange several of the parties. His son was going to fly bombing raids over France. Jack was proud that his father was proud. Vivi was delighted that her mother was making ice cream. It was the first outwardly kind gesture Buggy had made toward her daughter since Genevieve had talked Mr. Abbott into not sending her back to St. Augustine's. As Buggy cranked the ice cream freezer, Vivi hoped this was a sign things would get better between them. The sunlight hit Jack's jet-black hair. His skin was tanned, and he was thinner than usual, chiseled down to his essence. He tucked his fiddle under his chin and raised his bow, but before beginning to play, he paused. He glanced at Vivi and smiled. Then for some sweet Jack reason, he looked over at Buggy.
"Madame Abbott," he said, "how about I play this little waltz for you?"
It was the most gentlemanly thing Vivi had ever witnessed. As she watched her mother's face, she understood for the first time that no one, ever, had dedicated a song to Buggy Abbott. She watched as her mother raised her hand to her mouth, shy, embarrassed, and utterly delighted. Buggy let go of the ice cream crank, and the grinding sound of ice against wood gave way to silence. Then Jack began to play. He struck up Little Black Eyes, a waltz he knew Vivi loved. There was no war on the Abbott front porch that afternoon, just an overflowing of Cajun fiddle music, sweet, plaintive, from the heart. The notes danced through the June air. Vivi could feel them dust her hair and shoulders. She could feel the notes enter her and settle deep into her bones. Jack's notes tumbled over all of them that afternoon, as if there were an endless supply of music somewhere, waiting to be called forth. As Vivi listened to the music, she glanced at Buggy, and she noticed a smile she had never before seen on her mother's face. It was the smile of a girl, with her own longings, her own pleasures. It was a smile smiled for no one else. It was a smile that forgot about motherhood and the Catholic Church and the child clutching at her leg. For that one moment, Vivi saw Buggy as a person. The music and the fading afternoon light and the berries in the yellow bowl and the sun on Jack's face, Vivi's own bony body sitting in the swing surrounded by her friends and family, and the expression on her mother's face, all of this seared Vivi's heart for an instant, and she was filled with love. She credited it all to Jack. That is what Jack could do. He could crack her wide open to more love. He could transform the face of her mother. When the tune ended, everybody clapped. Jezzy, who had been mesmerized, called out, "Do again! Do again!" Pete and his buddies whistled and cheered, but it was Buggy who surprised Vivi most. She stepped over to Jack and gave him a kiss on the cheek, something she never did, not even with her own children. "Thank you, Jacques," she said. Then she took the corner of her apron, wiped her eyes, and resumed cranking the ice cream freezer. It was a small thing. Nobody noticed it but Vivi. Even if they had, they might not have thought it special, but Vivi loved her mother for it. On the day Buggy died, almost 40 years later, Vivi remembered the kiss her mother had given her beloved on that day, and the tear she had wiped away. And she loved her mother for it. She didn't forgive her mother for never loving her the way she needed, but she loved Buggy for that one kiss. In late October of 1943, Vivi Abbott was playing a mean game of singles against Ann McWaters. Back in shape, but still not at the top of her form, Vivi was to have played Caro that afternoon, but Caro had had to stay late at a yearbook meeting. Ann McWaters, Vivi's old rival, was beating her 3-2, and it was driving Vivi crazy. Ever since coming home from St. Augustine, she had devoted herself to tennis, and even though she was still a bit underweight, she'd picked up a lot of her old strength. But Ann McWaters could always throw her. The girl had a killer serve, and she knew how to keep her opponent running. Vivi was determined to close in on her, and thought she saw her chance when she noticed Pete ride up on his bicycle. Usually the arrival of a spectator wouldn't faze Vivi. On the contrary, she preferred to play most any game in front of an audience, but Pete's showing up anywhere without two or three buddies tailing along was unusual. "Vivo," Pete called out, his voice sounding strained. When Vivi didn't respond, Pete came closer to the fence that surrounded the city park courts. He was wearing a brown baseball cap over his auburn hair, and his nose was sunburned. It was October 19, 1943, around 5 p.m. Teensy and Vivi had a double date planned that night to see Orson Welles' Jane Eyre. A green Parks Department truck with a bad muffler passed by. Vivi's body was perfectly poised, ready for her opponent. Ann McWaters served hard, and Vivi returned it down the line. She'd worked extra hard at her backhand since coming home, and she knew how to keep her eye on the ball. She was training herself, once she stepped onto the court, to think of nothing but that ball. In the past few months, with Jack away, she devoted even more time to her tennis. She still dated, of course, still had at least 3 boys at any one time who claimed to be in love with her, but Vivi never gave them a thought, unless they were standing right in front of her. She thought more about Pauline Betts winning the U.S. singles than she did about any of those boys. Vivi thought about tennis, the war, and Jack Whitman. As Ann McWaters lobbed a high return, Vivi's mind was with the ball. Her body responded easily as she stepped back to get under it, in perfect position to take the point. At that moment, though, a bird flew close to the ball. It seemed to come out of nowhere, and it stole Vivi's attention. Never in her life had she seen a bird fly quite so close to a tennis ball. The bird mesmerized her for a second, causing her to forget about the ball, forget about the game, forget about everything but the bird's gray-blue wings against the October sky. Signaling a timeout, Vivi strode off the court to Pete. "Darn you, Pete, what do you want?" Pete looked at his sister for a moment, then turned away. "What do you want?" she asked again.
"Why don't y'all call a game, Vivo?" Pete said. "With McWaters leading, you gotta be kiddin'."
"Yoo-hoo!"
Ann called out, twirling her racket.
"Just a minute," Vivi called back. "I'm in the middle of a game, Pete. Either tell me what you want or let me get back on the court."
She waited for Pete to respond. When he didn't, she started back toward the court. As though it were easier to speak now that Vivi's back was to him, Pete said,
Teensy asked me to come get you. She wants you over at their house."
"Great," Vivi said, bouncing the ball with her racket, smiling at her opponent. "Tell her I'll be there as soon as I beat McWaters."
"I think you better come right now, Stinky," Pete said.
He shook a cigarette out of a lucky pack and lit it, his face pale in the fading light.
"Is something wrong?" Vivi asked, turning back to him.
Unable to meet her gaze, Pete said,
"Why don't you just come on with me? You can ride on the handlebars."
"No," Vivi said. "I don't want to come now. I want to finish this game."
Focusing her attention, Vivi resumed the game, smashing the ball hard. In the few minutes it took for her to win the game, each sensation was heightened for Vivi. She shook hands with Ann McWaters, then took her time gathering her racket press, the extra can of balls, her jacket. Stalling, she took a long drink of water and ignored Pete, who stood waiting, watching her every move. Finally, Pete rolled his bike to where Vivi stood, pulling on a sweatshirt over her blouse.
"Will you come on with me now, Vivo? Please, baby cakes?"
"You're being too nice to me," she said. "What the hell's going on?"
"Come on," he said, pointing to the bicycle handlebars. "Hop on."
Carrying her tennis racket, Vivi climbed onto the handlebars and balanced herself. As Pete pedaled, she looked straight ahead, and they did not speak. When they reached the bottom of the circular drive that led to Teensy's house, Vivi felt dizzy.
"Turn around," she said.
"What?"
Pete said, continuing to pedal. "I said turn around, Pete. I don't want to go in there."
Pete stopped pedaling. Vivi jumped down from the handlebars, her breath coming fast. She could feel herself begin to sweat as though she had been the one pumping the pedals for 8 blocks.
"What did you bring me here for?" she asked him, accusing.
"'Cause Teensy wants you."
"I want to know why. Tell me this instant."
Pete set his bike down on its side. It seemed to Vivi that it took him an inordinately long time to do it, like everything was happening in slow motion. She watched as he walked over and put his hands on her shoulders. She could smell spearmint gum over the scent of tobacco on his breath.
"It's Jack," he said,
the weight of his hands heavy on her shoulders.
Vivi appeared not to have heard.
What did you say? She asked.
Pete pulled her to him. She could smell the healthy smell of sweat and did not know whether it was her brother's or her own.
It's Jack, little sister, Pete said.
Vivi jerked away.
Genevieve got a telegram, he said,
choking up.
You're crazy, Vivi said, giving a small laugh.
You're joking.
I wish to God I was, Pete said.
You're messing with me, Vivi said. She shoved him on the arm as if to say the joke was over. Shake your head and say you're messing with me.
I'm not messing with you, Vivi, Pete said,
wiping the sleeve of his jacket across his face.
Shake your goddamn head, Pete.
Vivi, taking her brother's head in her hands, Vivi shook it from side to side. Pete let her do this for a moment, and when she did not stop, he reached up and took her hands in his. Lowering both their hands to his chest, he looked at her. Tears rolled down onto Pete's cheeks.
You gotta listen to me, baby sister. I am not making this up. This is real.
Vivi stared at their hands. She stared at her tennis racket, which lay on the ground where she had dropped it. She thought of homemade blackberry ice cream and the way Jack's face looked when he played music. She thought of the touch of his hand on her shoulder when they danced. A long thread of pain entered her through her feet and worked its way up into her heart, where it knotted, twisting so tightly that Vivi had to drop Pete's hands and rub her throat in order to continue breathing. Shirley, the Whitman's maid, sat on the bottom step of the winding staircase. Her head was in her hands, and when she looked up at Vivi and Pete, her black face was streaked with tears that shone silver in the fading light.
I knowed something bad was coming. Just yesterday I done heard a screech owl. Oh, I held that baby boy in my arm when he was born. I done blessed him with magnolia leaves like Miss Genevieve want. Poor Miss Vivi, you done lost your sweetheart. I done tried to get Miss Genevieve to drink her nerve tea, but she won't take it. Ça c'est dommage.
Vivi could hear Genevieve's screams coming from the master bedroom. She ran past Shirley and up the stairs. When she stepped into the bedroom, Genevieve was slapping Mr. Whitman on his face, his neck, his arm, whatever she could reach. Teensy stood by herself near the bay window, her hands covering her face.
Mon fille de grâce,
Genevieve screamed as she slapped her husband.
You killed my baby, you and your patriotisme.
Her reaction was so strong that it seemed to push the very air out of the room, leaving little space for anything else. Vivi wanted to hold Genevieve. She wanted to hold Teensy. She wanted them to hold her.
Oh, man.
Vivi heard Pete whisper as the two of them watched Genevieve claw at Mr. Whitman, dragging her nails along the side of his face. Mr. Whitman did not attempt to stop her as she began to kick at him and punch him, pummeling him wherever she could reach. The man stood there motionless in his gray pinstripes. Pete took Vivi's hand, and the two of them stood at the door. Everything seemed to be happening in slow motion. There was a lull, a drawing in of breath from Genevieve. Mr. Whitman slowly reached into his pocket and drew out a monogrammed handkerchief. Without speaking, he wiped his tears with the cloth and then cleaned the blood off his lips. Only when he was done with the handkerchief did he offer it to his wife, but she took no notice.
Jack would have offered the handkerchief to Genevieve first, Vivi thought. He would have shown good manners.
Genevieve turned to look at her daughter, then at Vivi. Both girls took steps toward her.
Genevieve will hug us now, Vivi thought. She will take us into her arms and tell us everything is all right.
But Genevieve took no one into her arms. Instead, she let out a low, keening sound, then pulled the skirt of her dress up over her head, revealing a beige slip and bare legs. It was the gesture of a small girl hiding her face. It was the gesture of a woman whose grief was too much to bear. The longer Genevieve stood there with her skirt above her head, the more Vivi's grief compounded. This was the woman she looked to when her own mother was absent. Now this mother, too, was turning away.
"Son," Vivi heard Mr. Whitman say.
Stepping forward, Pete answered,
"Sir?"
Pete did not know Mr. Whitman well, only to be polite to him at the bank or on the street. Mr. Whitman did not know Pete well either, only enough to nod if he passed him, perhaps note the touchdown he'd made the Friday night before. But on that day, as Pete stepped forward, Mr. Whitman reached out his arms, and the man and the boy fell into an embrace. Vivi would never again witness anything like it between two men. Often, later in her life, she would long to have her own sons and husband share such a moment. But that afternoon in the Whitman home, what she felt was envy. Envy that she herself was not encircled in the arms of a mother or a father. Finally, Vivi stopped waiting for Genevieve to lower her dress and hug her. She crossed the room to Teensy and took her into her arms. The two girls began to sob. Tori was working points from the base of Vivi's skull down into her shoulder blades when Vivi began to sob. Tori was not alarmed. It was not the first time that a client had cried in her massage room. Vivi took a deep breath as she lay face down on the massage table. Her body shuddered.
"I lost all my patriotism that day," she thought. "I lost my cheerleading self. From that day forward, when I jumped up and down for the team, I was an actress. A damn good actress. Only nobody gave out Oscars."
"Forgive me," she muttered to Tori. "I've got to get a grip."
Tori began to work Vivi's shoulders. The touch was so sure, so utterly free, that it released even more tears. Vivi's body shook, and the massage therapist stopped briefly to hand her a Kleenex. Vivi propped herself up on her elbows and blew her nose.
"Do you want to talk?" Tori asked.
"No," Vivi said, reaching for more tissues.
"Okay,"
Tori said.
"I will not ruin this massage by crying," Vivi thought.
But the more she strained not to cry, the more tense her body became. When Tori began to knead her shoulders, Vivi began to weep again.
"Let's just call it a day, shall we?"
Vivi said, lifting her head.
"I cannot seem to stop crying. I'm terribly sorry."
"Well," Tori said, pumping more lotion into her palm from a small plastic bottle she wore strapped to her waist.
"Don't call it a day on my account. You can cry and get massaged at the same time. Why don't you try picturing your tears like soft rain?"
Vivi lowered her head back into the padded face cradle. Tori began to lightly stroke Vivi's back and to rock her ever so slightly. Her hands were warm against Vivi's skin, and as Tori stroked, Vivi could feel her own breathing start to steady. Sometimes she could not believe that anyone could touch her body like this, with such acceptance, such loving detachment, asking for nothing in return. There were places she still could not bear to be touched, her belly for one. Her belly stuck out too much. She was ashamed of it, could not accept the idea that it was anything but hideous. There were other spots, though, her legs, her neck, her head, which luxuriated in being massaged. There were moments during her sessions with Tori that Vivi could only describe as religious. Moments when she came home to her body in ways she never had before. Moments when she felt its aches, varicose veins, and wrinkles so intimately and gently that she groaned with a happiness she could never describe. Fleeting seconds when Vivi knew that her body, in all its imperfections, was her own lived-in work of art. She lived there, and she'd die there. Her body had borne 4 children, 5 if you counted Sita's twin, which Vivi always did.
"I do want to talk,"
Vivi said softly. And so Vivi opened up to the massage therapist. She murmured her words in between sighs and tears, haltingly, but with an ease she had never known in a confessional.
I try to believe, she said, that God doesn't give you more than one little piece of the story at once. You know, the story of your life. Otherwise your heart would crack wider than you could handle. He only cracks it enough so you can still walk, like someone wearing a cast. But you've still got a crack running up your side, big enough for a sapling to grow out of. Only no one sees it. Nobody sees it. Everybody thinks you're one whole piece, and so they treat you maybe not so gentle as they would if they could see that crack.
Vivi sobbed. Tori placed one palm at the base of her spine and one at the base of her neck and pressed lightly. Vivi felt as though the massage therapist were touching her actual spinal cord, sending it messages to calm down.
I'm thinking, Vivi said, about an afternoon in my life when all the cracks were clear, like a pile of broken crockery.
Tori moved her hands to Vivi's shoulders. Vivi gave a little jump, as though from pain.
It is not in my personality to talk like this, she said.
Another sob escaped from her body.
But one of these days, I might trade in my personality for a new one. I might say, to hell with being popular. Y'all don't think I'm fun enough, then go screw yourselves.
Then Vivi forced a little laugh and started to sit up.
My God, I'm starting to sound like Blanche DuBois. I have always depended on the kindness of strangers.
Maybe I'm not a stranger, Tori said, pressing into Vivi's shoulder blades with her thumb.
Ouch, Vivi said. That hurts.
Why do you think your shoulders are so sore? Tori asked.
Oh, I carry a lot of heavy luggage with me, darling, Vivi answered. I carry footlockers.
Well, put them down for a few minutes while we work on this kink, Tori said. Okay?
Okay, Vivi said,
and sank down into the massage table. This table, she told herself, is held up by the floor, which is held up by the building, which is sunk deep into the earth, which is my home.
Chapter 23. Vivi put on her sunglasses before stepping out of the massage room. She did not want to talk to any of her health club pals, not the young men who always flirted with her and not the young women who worked for the cable TV station. Once, in her little convertible Miata, a surprise from Shep that she had broadly hinted for, she slipped the Barbra Streisand CD out of the player. She could not bear anything else that might make her cry. It was almost evening, but she didn't feel like going home. Instead, she drove toward Teensy's house. Vivi and Teensy had not just lost Jack. They lost Genevieve, too. For weeks after the telegram arrived, Genevieve saw no one, and when she did, it was to announce her belief that her son was not dead. According to Genevieve, Jack had survived his plane crash, and with the help of the French resistance was being cared for by village people in southern France. From that day forward, she refused to use her son's anglicized name, which her husband had always insisted on.
"Our Jacques is alive," Genevieve said, "without a doubt."
All she had to do was find him. In the few first months after Jack's death, Genevieve's fantasy impeded Vivi's own mourning. It was easy, with Vivi's imagination, to enter into the sad deception Genevieve offered. Falling asleep at night, Vivi would envision her sweetheart under the same moon she could see from her bedroom window. Together with Teensy and Genevieve, she spent countless hours studying maps of France. She devoured every shred of news she could find about the French resistance. She helped compose countless letters to the Army Air Corps, which Genevieve instructed Mr. Whitman's secretary to type. Wanting so hard to believe, for a while Vivi did believe. joining in Genevieve's tireless conversations about how Jack was doing, what food he was eating, what sort of bed he was sleeping in. Vivi sometimes grew giddy with the fiction they were creating. She agreed with Genevieve that, yes, of course, Jack was learning French folk songs on his fiddle. He was playing music and thinking of the time when he could come home. Each time Vivi began to cry, she felt guilty for giving up hope. She and Teensy would stand together in the hall by their lockers at school after lunch. Some afternoons they could not bear to walk into history class because the tears were falling too fast. Instead, they sat outside on the grass and cried. They didn't want any more history. They'd had enough history for a while. Vivi did not want Jack to be a part of history. She wanted him to eat hamburgers with her at LeMoyne's drive-in. She wanted to see him round the corner as she sat in a booth at Bordelon's drugstore. She wanted to see his eyes light up when she entered the room. She wanted him to hold her and give her back her life. For months, Vivi spent Friday and Saturday nights with Teensy, forsaking all offers of dates. Side by side, they would lie in bed and drink Cokes, and if Genevieve was not near, they would cry. Later, on those evenings, Caro and Nisi would drop by, and often Chick, Teensy's boyfriend, whose devotion to the Yayas never wavered. No one thought it odd in those days for two young women to lie in bed like that, holding each other in their flannel nightgowns, holding each other until they could stand up again and walk and talk and maybe start to pretend that their lives had not had a hole blown out of them. It was Buggy Abbott who had stepped in to crush the fantasy about Jack, a move that made Vivi at once thankful and resentful for the rest of her life. One Saturday night, a little over 3 months after the news of Jack's death, Buggy had knocked before entering Vivi's bedroom door. Vivi and Teensy were sprawled on the bed, surrounded by newspapers. It had become a weekend ritual for them to scour not only the Thornton paper, but also the Baton Rouge Daily Advocate and the New Orleans Times-Picayune for news of the French resistance. Buggy wore a high-necked gown with a robe tied around it. In her hand was an unlit sanctuary candle. Vivi was surprised to see her. Buggy had rarely entered her daughter's bedroom. "Vivi," Buggy said.
"Yes, ma'am."
"Y'all doing okay in here?"
Vivi nodded.
"Yes, ma'am. We're fine."
"Y'all want anything? I saved some peanut butter fudge for you."
"No, thank you," Vivi said. "We just had a Coke."
"Look, Vivi," Teensy said, holding up a page from one of the newspapers. "Here's something about a railway line being blown up outside Lyon, France."
"That's them, Vivi. I know it."
Vivi began to read the clipping, concentrating intently.
"The Lyon French Resistance Group is the one that first found Jack," Teensy explained to Buggy.
"Shh," Vivi said, trying to silence Teensy, who, like Genevieve, did not attempt to hide her beliefs about Jack's rescue. Buggy Abbott hesitated in the doorway for a moment before she crossed to the bed and sat on the edge.
"Y'all keeping real busy with your research, aren't you?"
she asked awkward.
"We make headway every day," Vivi said.
"There's a lot to do," Teensy explained. "Maman says we should put in at least 4 hours a day on our research."
Buggy nodded. She was afraid of what was happening to her daughter, but she did not know what to do. She watched as Vivi studied the article in front of her, marking it with a red pencil, then clipping it out of the newspaper with a pair of manicure scissors.
"Hand me the Lyon file," Vivi said to Teensy.
Teensy reached for a manila envelope, one of the many that Genevieve had procured from the bank to hold their burgeoning files. As Vivi bent over the envelope, a strand of hair fell from her ponytail into her face. Just as she was about to push it back, Buggy reached up and did it for her. For just the blink of an eye, Buggy let her hand linger gently against her daughter's cheek. But it was long enough for Vivi to sense the clumsy tenderness. Looking up, Vivi asked,
"What's the candle for, Mother?"
"I was wondering," Buggy said, "if
y'all might want to pray with me tonight, for just a moment."
Her voice sounded unsure, almost shy. Vivi looked at Teensy, who shrugged her shoulders.
"Okay," Vivi said. "We'll pray with you."
Reaching into the pocket of her robe, Buggy pulled out matches. She lit the candle, then set it on the bedside table. Kneeling at the side of her daughter's bed, Buggy began to pray.
"Blessed lady,"
she said softly, praying in the language of the ancient Mary masses.
"Virgin greeted by Gabriel, light for the weak, star in the darkness, shining with brilliant light. Comforter of the afflicted, you know the sorrows of all your children. Take our pain into your heart and bless it. Gracious lady, gentle and sweet, we cry to you for solace. Be with us in our time of sadness. Holy Mother, shining with brilliant ray, remember the soul of Jack Whitman, who has been called to your loving bosom. Remember Newton Jacques Whitman, whom we have loved."
With those words, Buggy Abbott pierced Genevieve Whitman's delusion, which had held her daughter in its grip. The candle flickered beside her daughter's bed, and its tiny flame released Vivi. That night, Vivi, who had up to that point thought she knew what suffering was, suffered even more. In her sleep, she let go of Genevieve's fantasy, and when she woke the next day, it was to a new world in which her loss was real. When Vivi and Teensy attempted to confront Genevieve about the implausibility of Jack's having survived the crash, she would not listen.
"Sans aucun doute, without a doubt,"
Genevieve muttered over and over, as if the words were an incantation, a mantra that could make her fantasy come true. Vivi remembered all this as she pulled into Teensy's drive.
How could 5 decades have passed so quickly? How many years went by unnoticed, unembraced?
French mulberry bushes grew near the brick wall that ringed Teensy and Chick's huge yard, and rows of thick mondo grass and large camellia bushes edged the circular drive, all plantings put in by Genevieve many years ago. "Remember the soul of Jack Whitman," Vivi prayed as she reached to open the door of her Miata. "Remember Newton Jacques Whitman, whom we have loved." 10 minutes later, as Vivi sat on the pool patio with Teensy, she fell into the shorthand of their long friendship. A luxuriant honeysuckle supported by a trellis hung lazily over their heads, while caladiums, impatience, and elephant ears grew in wild profusion around a fountain from which sprang a stone mermaid. It was an old patio, an old tile pool, and the feeling was one of a meticulous balance of cultivation and wildness.
"The silly thing with the scrapbook has me thinking about Genevieve," Vivi said.
Teensy said nothing for a moment, then asked,
"Without a doubt?"
"Exactly." Vivi nodded, comforted by the fact that she was not alone with this memory. Arriving with a tray with drinks for the two women, Chick looked at Vivi and Teensy and tried to gauge their mood.
"Y'all want me to put on a couple of filet mignon?"
Give us an hour or so, please, baby,"
Teensy responded, blowing him a kiss through the air.
"Sans moi?"
he asked, looking at the two old friends.
"Yep," Vivi said, giving him a smile. "Sans toi." "Holla if y'all need anything, mesdames," he said, giving a stagey little bow. "I'll be inside marinating. Vegetables, that is."
Vivi and Teensy reached for their drinks, then sat in silence. The hissing of lawn sprinklers and the soft slap-slap sound of water as it circulated out of the swimming pool mixed with the growing songs of crickets and the trickling sound from the fountain. Early evening sunlight hit the pool water as Vivi sipped her bourbon and Teensy her gin. Amazing how that one phrase, without a doubt, held such meaning. How it recalls Genevieve's long decline,
her inability to accept Jack's death, the shortwave radio in her bedroom, the middle-of-the-night calls to the White House, the all-night strategy sessions to stage Jack's return. Then finally, after the war, the disastrous trip to France, where there was, of course, no trace of her son. Only devastation, disorientation, displacement. And the years that followed, years when Genevieve did not leave her bedroom, which had become a pharmacopoeia.
It's the things that aren't in that scrapbook, Vivi said elliptically. The little big things.
Dog tags. She heard a sharp intake of breath from Teensy.
Oh, if there had been anything, Teens, Vivi continued, anything. His dog tags, his boots, the St. Jude scapula, anything. Genevieve could have accepted it if there'd only been something for her to touch, some little piece, some stupid tiny object. I have sent my oldest daughter, the Grand Inquisitor, our divine secrets of the Yaya sisterhood. But there's so much I didn't give her, cannot give her, cannot give myself.
Vivi took a deep breath.
I don't suppose y'all have any goddamn cigarettes round here, do you? Vivi asked. I know none of us smoke anymore, but I could use something to gesture with.
Teensy walked over to a hutch at the outdoor kitchen end of the patio. She returned with a silver cigarette case, which she opened and offered to Vivi. Vivi took two cigarettes and handed one to Teensy.
Shall we light? Teensy asked.
Will Chick find out? Vivi asked, sounding like a girl.
He knows, Teensy said.
Let's light then, Vivi said, and allowed Teensy to light their cigarettes with a box of matches that sat on the glass patio table beside them.
Every time I light a cig these days, I say a Hail Mary for Carol, Teensy said.
Vivi turned to look at her old friend. Teensy was still tiny, with stylishly cut, subtly colored dark hair, with just the right amount of silver peeking through. She wore a pair of red silk pencil leg pants with a black shell. On her size 5 feet were a pair of little black and white striped espadrilles. As she smoked, Vivi could see the sunspots on her friend's small hands.
Mamo, Teensy said, as though the word itself were an incantation. There is no escape from our mothers. I don't even want to escape anymore.
Gazing out at the pool, then over at the fountain, Vivi thought, maybe we aren't meant to escape our mothers.
What a goddamn scary thought.
She pictured Genevieve wearing a turban, dancing and singing while she cooked crayfish etouffee. Genevieve with that Cajun patois, that laugh of hers, those misbehaving eyes. Genevieve hauling the four yayas to Marksville for the pirogue races. The hot boudin, the cochon de lait, the thick black café at 4:30 in the morning on the way to the fisherman's mass. Genevieve hauling her out of that hell hole of a boarding school. Vivi Walker's life would not have been the same without Genevieve Whitman.
Sitta wouldn't be such a worrywart if she'd known Genevieve, Vivi said. Don't kid yourself, Teensy said. Maman retreated to some bayou in her head long before Sidda saw the light of day.
Vivi knew that was true, but still could not help wishing her daughter had known the woman who had been such a beacon. Why were memories flooding in like some internal levee had burst? Was it age? Was it the fight with Sidda? As Vivi smoked, she remembered how she'd visit with Genevieve when she was pregnant with Sidda and the twin. Sometimes, on good days, the Yayas would spend whole afternoons with Genevieve in her bedroom. Vivi, 6 months and huge, Teensy, 4 months, but barely showing, Nisi, pregnant for the second time and beginning to put on weight all over, Caro, the biggest of them, fit and strong and big as a horse. The four of them, beached whales, surrounding Genevieve, snacking on sandwiches and Bloody Marys that Shirley brought up on a tray. Janvier's boudoir, on a good day, had the feeling of an intimate, if slightly bizarre, bistro. Genevieve would be propped up, dressed in one of her gorgeous bed jackets, 10,000 pill bottles on her bed table, her thick black hair piled up on her head, her nails perfectly done, surrounded by freesias, her favorite flower. She'd listen to every single detail of the Yaya's pregnancies. No detail bored her. Then, lapsing into her patois, Genevieve would give them remedies she'd learned growing up on the bayou. To keep the devil away, let the baby teethe on a necklace of alligator teeth. Show them spooks who is boss. For teething, take crawfish, rub the children's teeth, will make them cut easy. Always remember, Genevieve would say to the expectant Yayas, sometime the baby, she has to get sick to get well. On bad days, the boudoir lamps weren't even turned on. Genevieve's room was kept dark. She wanted no light. The bad days finally stretched to weeks, then to months. Finally, only Teensy was welcomed into her mother's bedroom. One afternoon when Sitta was a little over a month old, Vivi stopped in to show Sitta to Genevieve. It was Vivi's first trip out after losing the twin, and she was trying to pull herself out of depression. She intended to ask Genevieve to be Sitta's godmother. Caro had driven Vivi and the baby to the Whitman home. When they arrived, Shirley met them at the front door.
Miss Vivi, Miss Caro, y'all kinda wait in the living room?
When Teensy came down the stairs, she looked exhausted. Her swollen body looked like a volleyball had been placed in the waistband of an adolescent girl's skirt.
Maman's sleeping today, she said. I'm sorry. She's not doing so good.
Is she sleeping, Caro asked, or did they give her another shot?
Another shot, Teensy whispered.
She lifted the baby blanket to peek at Sitta, sleeping in Vivi's arms.
Lashes to die for.
Like ships, Vivi said.
Little one, Teensy whispered to the baby. I don't think my maman can be your maran.
Then she folded the blanket back over Sitta's tiny head. She did it quickly, as if she couldn't bear to see the baby's face for another instant.
Vivi, she said, ask Caro to be the godmother.
Why? Vivi asked. It doesn't matter if Genevieve can't be at the baptism. I want Genevieve to be.
Don't argue with me, Vivi, Teensy said. Please.
Couldn't I just show Sitta to Genevieve? Vivi asked.
Teensy looked as though she were barely holding on.
I'm sorry, Vivi, she said.
Sitta never got to meet Genevieve St. Clair Whitman. A month after Sitta's baptism, Vivi was lying on a green and blue plaid spread on top of the daybed. Sitta lay next to her, sucking on her bottle. It was a moment when she had managed to put the lost twin in God's hands for a few hours and cuddle up inside her life, and she was thankful. Shep was in the kitchen, mixing a drink and slicing some cheese to go with crackers. He was the one who took the phone call from Chick. Vivi could hear the sound of him talking, but couldn't make out what he was saying. She was in a sweet, dreamy time with her new baby.
My husband is going to bring me appetizers, then broil me a steak, she thought. I look pretty damn good for a woman who has just had a baby.
Baby?
Shep said, walking back into the room with her bourbon.
Baby yourself, she said, patting the bed. Come sit.
Vivi wanted her little family curled around her. She was a new mother with a handsome husband and a beautiful and healthy red-headed daughter. She might have lost a child. She might have been doing battles with the demons. But that evening she was in a glow, and she knew it. Vivi could feel the bright center spotlight shining on her.
Look at this darling girl, she whispered to Shep. Just look at her.
Vivi took a sip of her drink, then set it on the table next to the daybed. She began to whisper to Sitta,
you have pretty eyes, big as plates, and a perfect nose, and sweet little lips. You have tan, yummy toes,
and tan, yummy fingers, and pretty little legs. I just want to eat you up.
Shep looked at his infant daughter for a moment, then at his wife. He hated to ruin the sweetest moment they'd had since the twin died.
"The good French lady has left us, Vivi," he said softly.
Vivi wasn't paying attention to him. She was in Sitta's sweet, powdery little world. She was holding the bottle to Sitta's lovely lips. She watched her daughter's eyes starting to get heavy as she finished the bottle. Bending down, Shep started to pick up Sitta. He had slipped one of his hands under her tiny back.
"Don't pick her up yet, baby doll," Vivi said. "Let her drift all the way off. Then I'll burp her and put her to bed."
Usually Shep let Vivi tell him what to do with his daughter. He didn't touch Sitta without Vivi's instruction or permission. This time, however, he left his hand under Sitta's back for a moment, hesitating. Then he scooped her up, taking the bottle out of Vivi's hands.
"What are you doing, Shep? You want to finish feeding her?"
Shep stood, holding Sitta in one hand at his hip. Vivi sat up, still in a good mood, ready to indulge her husband.
"Vivi, Genevieve has passed over," he said, watching his wife closely.
The taste of iron seeped into Vivi's mouth. She stood up. "Strange," she thought. "I did not taste iron when the twin died. I have not tasted it since Jack died." "What happened?" she asked, not wanting to know. Shep looked down at the baby girl in his arms. He did not want to tell his wife what he had to say.
"Babe, I'm awful sorry. But I think the alligator's got her."
Vivi looked down into her daughter's sleepy eyes. For a moment, Vivi could not see her daughter. She could only see her own shocked expression reflected back to her from the baby's large hazel eyes.
"Can I do something, Vivi?" Shep asked. "Is there something I can do for you, babe?"
Vivi shook her head.
"There's nothing you can do for me.
Finish feeding your daughter. Then burp her and check a diaper. I'll be in the bedroom on the phone. Please don't disturb me." Then Vivi turned and walked out of the room, and Sitta began to cry. Shep Walker lifted the infant up in the air so that Sitta's baby body was slightly above his face. He did not know why she was crying. He did not know how to make her stop.
"Hey, little Butterbean," he said, "everything's okay. You got your papa's eyes, you know it. You got your mama's set of lungs. And your papa's eyes."
"Can I talk?"
Vivi asked Teensy, who was now stretched out on a lounge chair, her shoes kicked off.
"What do you mean, can you talk?" Teensy said. "The only way any of us are going to stay out of the beddy is to talk." "I have realized that I do not forgive Holy Mother Church," Vivi said. "I thought I had, but I haven't. They should have let us bury Genevieve in the Divine Compassion Graveyard.
HMC still doesn't like final exits via barbiturate vodka cocktails," Teensy said, sounding vulnerable in spite of her tough words.
"I kept going to Mass," Vivi said, "even though you quit. Even though Carol gave up on confession, I kept up everything, just like Nisi. Even after I had to switch confessors after Sitta told the world I was the Hitler of motherhood. All my life I've been a sucker for that pure, light feeling you get for 2.5 minutes after you come clean in confession. The feeling that if you got run over by a truck, you'd be just fine.
I gave up on that when they told me my striptease was a mortal sin," Teensy said.
"You're smarter than me, Teensy Boo,"
Teensy laughed.
"In the land of the blind, the nearsighted man is king."
After taking a sip of her drink, Teensy continued, "I am not smarter, Vivi, but I know my ma loved me. She did not kill herself because she did not love me. She killed herself because she believed she had let my father kill my brother. She left that in her note. My father is the one she punished the most." Teensy sighed.
and took a sip out of her drink. "Do you miss him?" Vivi asked. "I miss Jack every day of the world," Teensy said softly. "But not in the way you do. He was my brother. I have spent my life with the man I love." "I can still close my eyes and see Jack," Vivi said. "See him running down the court with a basketball, jumping off that rope swing at Spring Creek. Teensy, I can still see him. I don't know if you even remember the time at the Gulf when..." Vivi paused to look away. "God, am I crazy, still carrying on like this? Am I one of those nuts who never get over high school, for Christ's sake?" "My brother was your true love, baby," Teensy said. "Yes," Vivi said, and took a sip of her bourbon. "And I would still give everything I have to smell his scent one more time before I die." "That's something I don't forgive," Teensy said. "What?" Vivi asked. "God taking Jack. I'm glad we beat the Japs, and I'm proud we stopped Hitler, but I still don't think my brother should have died in that war. It's how come you and I understood the kids when they were against Vietnam. Patriotism is a crock. True love is not a crock, but patriotism is, Cher. The Catholic Church and the United States military really ought not to mess with the yah-yahs," Vivi said. Opening the set of French doors that led from the living room to the patio, Chick said, "Do I hear y'all plotting against church and state? Please, Teensy, I don't want the FBI bothering us again." Teensy and Vivi laughed. "You crazy fool," Vivi said. "How's your marinade?"
"Just called me Julia Child,"
Chick replied, affecting the famous chef's voice.
"Y'all need refreshing?"
"Oui, oui, s'il vous plaît," Teensy said. "And baby, we're almost ready to eat. What can we do to help?"
"I've got it," Chick said. "Y'all stay put. I'm enjoying myself."
"Love you," Teensy said, standing up and kissing him lightly before she sat back down. When Chick turned to go back inside, Vivi caught Teensy's eye.
"How many years?" she asked.
"Almost golden," Teensy replied.
"Golden from the beginning," Vivi said.
"He's been there through it all. I don't have to tell you about that," Teensy said. "I could not have lived my life after Jack and Maman if Chick hadn't been by my side. Chick and the three of y'all."
Vivi looked at her friend.
"You are both blessed. Blessed and lucky. And neither of us sweat a petit caca," Teensy said.